Welcome to the Emma Solve Cases broadcast. Today we'll be talking about the case of Jacob Wetterling from St. Joseph's, Minnesota. My name is Emma, and as always, I obtain this information all online, so if I'm missing anything or have any information wrong, please just let me know in the comment section below, as I'd like to know the truth of what happened. I'm not trying to give you guys any wrong facts, so if you know anything that I don't, please let me know. And just as a disclaimer, I mean no disrespect to the Wetterling family by sharing this case. I'm just doing it to educate people who listen to my broadcast. Before I get started, this podcast is sponsored by Audible. I'm sure you guys have heard of it, but if you haven't, it's an online company where you can go on and listen to different Audible books. It's perfect to use when I'm in the car or even walking my dog or even in the shower. The books are so interesting and have every genre to choose from, especially crime, which I always listen to. So I'll leave the link to their website below. Let's just jump into the case. So Jacob Wetterling was born on February 17th, 1978 in St. Joseph's, Minnesota. His parents were Patty and John Jerry Wetterling. They had three other children, Carmen, Amy, and Trevor. The family grew up in a small town with a population of 2,500. They lived on the outskirts on a cul-de-sac and were surrounded by cornfields, bushes, and trees. They had a long dirt driveway leading up to their house, and all the neighbors were pretty spread apart. They all had big properties, like, for kids to run around, so the neighbors' houses weren't that close. Jacob was a sweet kid. He played hockey and basketball and loved watching football. So the day of his kidnapping, October 22nd, 1989, was a pretty normal day for the family. Jacob and his dad woke up early to go fishing, which Jacob loved. He loved fishing, especially with his dad, so it was a good start to their day. Then they came home from fishing and watched the Vikings versus Detroit Lions football game, and then they went indoor ice skating with his family. This didn't really seem like just a normal day. It was actually a really nice day. The family went out and really enjoyed the day together and had just a nice day doing a bunch of things together. Then that night, Patty and Jerry had a dinner party at a friend's house. They actually weren't planning on staying out too late, so they told the kids that they could stay home, and Jacob had a friend over who also stayed with them. The kids had no school the next day, so they were just going to hang out and have some pizza. Jacob's sister Amy was at a friend's house because, again, they didn't have school the next day. Patty and Jerry left the home at 5:30 p.m., and the dinner was 25 miles away, so about a 25-minute drive from the Wetterlings' home. At the home was Carmen, who was 8, Trevor, who was 10, Jacob, who was 11, and Jacob's friend Aaron, who was also 11. The kids were just eating pizza, and they decided to rent a movie at the Tom Thumb in town, which was about a 15-minute bike ride from the Wetterlings' house. Jacob then called his mom, and she said no to them going. Then Jacob asked his dad, and he said yes, as long as they bring flashlights and wear reflective vests. Personally, learning this part of the case was just really sad for me, knowing that Jerry actually overruled Patty's decision in letting them go, and knowing how much guilt Jerry probably feels, because his decision was the difference between Jacob's life and death. And I just thought that's really sad, because he definitely blames himself a lot for it. But I just thought that was really sad. So then the boys headed off to Tom Thumb and left their little sister Carmen with their next door neighbor Michelle, who was 14, and Michelle just came to the Wetterlings' house just to watch her while the boys went into town. So on their way into town, the boys heard rustling in the cornfields next to them, but they didn't think too much of it and figured it was probably an animal and just kept going. They got to the Tom Thumb, rented the movie Naked Gun, and started heading home. It was now dark out, and the boys were biking. The boys got to a neighbor's long dirt driveway about 2 to 3 minutes away from the Wetterlings' house, when a man walked up to them wearing a black mask and all black clothing. The man told the boys, "I have a gun. Put your bikes in the ditch and lie face down in the ditch, or I'll shoot." The boys thought this might have been some older kids pranking them, but did what the man said. The man then asked Trevor his age. When he replied saying he was 10, the man told Trevor to run away into the bushes as fast as he could and to not look back, or he would shoot him. So Trevor ran. The man then asked Jacob and Aaron to stand up and ask their age. They both replied 11. The man was now groping and touching Jacob at this point. Then the man told Aaron the same thing as Trevor, to run off as fast as he could and to not look back, or he would shoot. Aaron actually ran so fast he caught up to Trevor. And by the time he caught up, they turned around and Jacob and the man were gone. So it was 9:20 p.m., the last time Jacob was ever seen alive. Trevor and Aaron ran back to the Wetterlings and told Michelle that Jacob was taken. Michelle then went next door to tell her father, Mel Jerzak. Mel then called Patty and Jerry and told them to come home immediately because Jacob was gone. Then Mel called 911. The police arrived and questioned Trevor and Aaron. At first, the police did not believe what the boys were saying. They thought the boys were lying because Jacob might have run away or they accidentally shot him and were trying to cover it up. So at 10:45, the search for Jacob started. Firefighters, police, volunteers, and helicopters all looked for Jacob all over the area. The police did not question any of the neighbors for some reason, this including Dan Razia. Dan was a neighbor of the Wetterlings. He was a high school music teacher. Dan said he heard his dog Smokey barking at a car that pulled into his driveway, turned around, and drove off at 9 p.m. Then at 10:30, he woke up to his dog barking again at people looking through his woodpile at the end of his driveway. He went out to talk to them and scare them off, but he realized there was a lot of them, so he went inside, called the police, and they assured him that it was just a search looking for Jacob. He then ended up going back out and talking to the people and helping them look. This case ended up turning into a huge case. Jacob's parents took every opportunity to go on air and do interviews to get the word out and urge people to look. In the week following his disappearance, police all around Minnesota were looking for Jacob. Thousands of people even made a human chain down the road Jacob went missing. And by 2016, the case had 70,000 leads, and the police investigated every single one. I thought this was really good just because there were so many leads to this case because of the lack of evidence and the many possible scenarios that this, like, how this could have happened. And I just thought it was good that they literally looked into every single one and tried their best to find out what happened to Jacob. So then in 2004, Dan Razia was actually the main suspect of the case. He was the neighbor with the long driveway and the wood pile. In 2002, John Senna became the St. Joseph's County Sheriff, and he swore to solve the case of Jacob. So up until 14 years after Jacob was abducted, the main theory of what happened to Jacob was that he was abducted in a vehicle. Then in 2004, Senna and his team came up with a new theory, and they theorized the abduction was done on foot by someone nearby, which is why Dan Razia was the perfect suspect, as he was the neighbor and he was awake during the time that it happened, or he said that he was. So the theory came about with a teenager named Kevin and his girlfriend. On the night Jacob was abducted, they were sitting in Kevin's car listening to the police scanner, which anyone can do. Basically, if you have a radio, you can just listen to the police scanner. Like, it's completely legal and okay. So they ended up hearing what happened to Jacob, and they went to go check it out. They pulled onto the street, and they actually saw the boys' bikes. They debated picking them up, but they decided to just leave them. They then pulled into a driveway, turned around, and left. Kevin told the story to everyone, and even eventually told it to a federal investigator. The investigator then urged Kevin to tell the police what happened, so he did. This explained the car Dan saw pull into his driveway and turn around, and the tracks on the road. So this disqualified any theory of him being abducted by the car that Dan saw. So on the 30th of June 2010, the police conducted a two-day search of Dan's house. They tore it apart and actually used construction equipment to dig up the ground where Dan and his family dumped their ashes from their fires, but they found absolutely nothing in Dan's house. Dan's face was displayed everywhere as the murderer, and he was treated horribly by everyone in town. Dan even filed a complaint and attempted to sue the sheriff, but it was passed off. He was treated horribly and just like an outsider until the 28th of October 2015, when there was a new suspect name. Danny Heinrich was concluded as the main suspect when Jared Shell looked into the case. So Danny was actually connected by DNA evidence to another sexual assault, and that was the sexual assault of Jared Shell. When Jared realized his story and Jacob's were very similar, he connected the dots. So, Jared was abducted on January 13th, 1989, just 9 months before Jacob's abduction. Jared lives in Cold Spring, Minnesota, which was very close to where Jacob lived. Jared said he went ice skating with his friends the day of his disappearance, then they went to a cafe in town, and then when they left, him and his friend walked home together, but since they didn't live together, they had to split up at some point. They split up 5 minutes away from Jared's house, and when he was walking alone, a man pulled up beside him in a blue car and asked him for directions. When he got close enough to the car, he then told Jared to get in the car and that he had a gun and was not afraid to use it. He then told Jared to get in the back seat, lie face down, and put a hat over his head so he couldn't see. The man drove 10 to 15 minutes, and Jared was trying to remember every turn. He tried to remember every left, every right, but he eventually lost track after they went over some train tracks. The man then stopped the car, got in the back seat, and sexually assaulted Jared. The man then drove him back to town and said the same thing he said to Trevor and Aaron. Run away as fast as you can and don't look back or I'll shoot you. He actually ended up dropping him off about like 3 minutes away from his house. But so then Danny was questioned and he gave the police a sample of his hair, his shoes, and his ties. The police then got a search warrant for Danny's father's house because that's where he was living at the time of the assault. The police then found black boots, camo pants, police scanners, and several locked trunks. In the trunks, the police found two home photos. One was of a boy in his underwear, and one was of a boy in his towel. Danny assured the police that it wasn't what it looked like, and the police actually ended up giving him back the photos, which he later burned, and he was let go. In 2015, Jared connected the dots between the cases, and Danny moved to Painesville, which was really close to Cold Springs and St. Joseph's. Jared then got in touch with the investigators on Jacob's case, and they tested Jared's sweater. They still had an evidence because they had the sweater that he was wearing the night of his assault, and they just always kept it just in case they needed it for evidence or whatever. So they tested the sweater, and it matched from Danny's hair. It was a DNA evidence match. But unfortunately, Jared's case was a statute of limitations. So if you don't know what that is, a statute of limitations is basically when a case has been open for too long, so it's closed. And basically, if you solve it and you find out who did it, the statute of limitations is there, so the person cannot get charged because basically the case is expired. The police then did get a warrant to search Danny's house on July 28, 2015. They found duct tape, handcuffs, 4 bins full of little boys' clothing, VHS tapes of young boys doing different things, like such as bending over or undressing, and 19 binders full of child pornography, all in Danny's home. Danny was then charged with 25 counts of possession and receipt of child pornography, and Danny served 1 year in jail while awaiting his trial. Then, 3 weeks prior to Danny's trial, his lawyers came up with a plea deal, and this just makes me really mad, just because it really shows how shitty the justice system is, and it just really bothered me when I researched this case. But basically the plea deal was that if Danny confessed to Jacob's murder with a detailed description of what happened and like shares where he buried the body, he would walk away with only one charge of child pornography. So I think the Wetterling family, they actually did agreed to the plea deal. I feel like they just wanted it just because of closure. They've been waiting 24 years to find out what happened to their son. And I think they just wanted closure. They just didn't want to worry anymore. They just wanted to know what happened to their son. So they agreed to the plea deal. So Danny's confession was actually extremely detailed. Danny said he was driving around the St. Joseph's area for no rhyme or reason on October 22nd, 1989. When he saw the three boys biking into town. He then parked his car on the side of the road and waited for them to return. When he saw them coming back, he got out of his car and walked towards the boys. After he sent Aaron and Trevor running away, he handcuffed Jacob, put him in the front seat of his car, and drove away. Jacob was actually crying and asking what he did wrong, and Danny then heard the police scanner report Jacob as missing, and he told Jacob to lean down so no one could see him sitting in the front seat. Danny drove around for a while before parking in Painesville. He then parked at a gravel pit and told Jacob to get out of the car. They both got out of the car, and Danny took the handcuffs off of Jacob and told him to undress and touch himself. He then sexually assaulted Jacob. Jacob was crying and saying he was cold and that he wanted to go home. And then Danny told Jacob to get dressed. Then Danny heard a patrol car drive by, which was actually completely unrelated to Jacob. They weren't even searching for him or looking for him. They were actually called on another case that night. They weren't even looking for Jacob, but that scared Danny. So then Danny told Jacob to turn around, and he pulled out his gun and pulled the trigger, but the gun actually jammed, so the gun didn't go off, and Jacob was just left standing there. And that really broke my heart, just knowing how scared Danny probably was in his last moments, just knowing that he was about to die and hearing the gun jam. Like, that just honestly really broke my heart. Anyway, then Danny shot the gun again and Jacob fell to the ground. Danny left the body there and went home for a few hours for some reason. He then went back to bury the body. He claimed he dug a grave, but it was too small, and Jacob's body wouldn't fit, so he went to a nearby construction site and used a bobcat to bury Jacob. Danny then realized he forgot to bury Jacob's shoes, so he threw them in a nearby ravine and went home. Danny actually then returned a year later to the place he buried Jacob, just to move the body. He never said why he wanted to do that, but he moved it to a cow pasture in a hole 2 feet deep. After his confession, the police went to the burial site with a metal detector to find the body. The night Jacob went missing, he was wearing a red vest. The red vest was plastered everywhere. It was basically like, look for this jacket, because it was so noticeable on someone. It was bright red. And the vest had metal buttons, so the police were going to use the metal detector to detect where the buttons were under the ground. But when the police actually arrived, they didn't need to use the metal detector, because after this whole time, 23 years after the body was buried, police got to the site and found a piece of red fabric just sticking out of the ground that no one had found. That part in the story is just horrible. Just knowing that it was literally right there the whole time, anyone could have just seen it, and it just went unnoticed for 23 years, that there was just a red piece of fabric sticking out of the ground. It just made me really sad to read that. This whole case is just really sad, honestly. It's just like, I don't know. But Danny Heinrich was guilty of the murder, but faced no jail time and was only charged with one charge of possession of child pornography. So this case was really sad for me, just because it went unsolved for 24 years, just for it to be solved and the murderer was set free. While I was researching this case, I found out that every year on Jacob's birthday, Patty and Jerry lit a candle on a cupcake for him, and that every single night since he disappeared, every night, his family left the lights on for him in case he came home. And that just broke my heart, because all their hopes were just crushed as soon as this plea deal was arranged, and it just made me so sad that this is just how it ended and they got really no justice. I guess they got some closure and they don't have to worry or like be confused about what happened, but honestly it's just really sad that the way that this ended and they didn't really get any justice for Jacob. So that is the case of Jacob Wetterling. Again, if I included any wrong information or missed anything, please let me know below. I always want to know if I mess up the cases or if I miss anything. So thank you for listening to my podcast. This is Emma Solve Cases, signing off. Bye.